Money Roots is made possible by the support of our sponsor, Rooted Planning Group. Are you ready to take control of your financial future? Look no further than Rooted Planning Group, your trusted partner in financial well-being. At www.rootedpg.com, you'll discover a wealth of resources and expertise to help you thrive financially. Rooted Planning Group specializes in personalized financial planning, investment management, and retirement strategies. They understand that every financial journey is unique, and they're here to guide you every step of the way. With a team of experienced advisors, Rooted Planning Group is committed to helping you cultivate a secure and prosperous future. Visit www.rootedpg.com today to learn more about how Rooted Planning Group can help you grow your money roots.
The undergrad situation is bad, but it could be worse. The graduate school and professional school world, however, that uncapped borrowing arrangement, unlike the Parent Plus loans, they're not allowed anymore for graduate school and professional school loans. So you take all the loans out in your own name for grad school. And then furthermore, there's no limit on the amount that you can borrow, which this happened in 2006 with the passing of the Grad Plus program. And it's really kind of funny or sad, I don't know which word you choose, but you can see the tuition at a lot of universities for their grad school programs after this passed, it just skyrocketed. It went way up. And why is that? Well, they figured out that if you can borrow up to the cost of attendance, then what's an easy way to increase revenue? Increase the cost of attendance. And so that's what a lot of places did. And what you now have, since you don't have any private involvement in our underwriting standards over whether or not it's a good decision to take out a degree. And so, for example, a chiropractor, the average chiropractor now, will graduate with about $200,000 to $250,000 of student loans, and they'll make $50,000 a year. The typical dentist will graduate with about $300,000 of student loans, and they'll have about $120,000 of income a year. That's not to say that there are not successful chiropractors and dentists, but what's happening in a lot of schools is university officials, in the absence of any kind of consumer protections, are out and out lying to people. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, doing something that, if it's not legally fraud, I think it should be considered fraud.
Hey, podcast listeners, Amy Irvine here. I know that you know I'm an ambassador for the Seneca Lake Wine Trail, and I have quite an exploration that I want you to go on. So when I was 40, my husband took me to this wonderful castle called Bellhurst Castle. On this wonderful birthday, he also got me a delightful massage. And after the 90 minutes I spent getting that massage, I walked downstairs into this delightful little lodge and had a great glass of red wine at this winery. You know that I'm a big red wine fan, and they have a delicious Pinot Noir as well as their Cab Sauvignon, but this time of year I really love their Pinot Noir. It is a place that you just want to go to. When I say castle, I mean castle. Venture on out to this wonderful location. If you're not from New York, come here and enjoy this beautiful view, beautiful location, and delicious wine. That's Bellhurst Estate Winery, Bellhurst Estate. Go online, look at their website, order some of their wine, and pretend you're the queen of your castle, or of course, the king. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we hope you enjoy this podcast.
You are listening to Wine and Dime, a podcast that combines two passions, wine and personal finance. Hosted by Amy Irvine, certified financial planner and owner of Irvine Wealth Planning Strategies, located in Corning, New York. And now, here's your host, Amy Irvine.
Welcome to this edition of Wine and Dime with Amy Irvine. Today's guest is Travis Hornsby. He is a CFA and the founder of something that I think a lot of you are going to be very interested in. His website is studentloanplanner.com. And for those of you that know me, you know this is a topic that I am very passionate and sometimes angry about. Welcome to the show, Travis.
Thanks, Amy. Great to be here.
So Travis, if you've listened to the show, you know I like to open it with one of my favorite topics, which is, what is your favorite wine and why?
So this hopefully doesn't reflect poorly on me, but my favorite is Sam's Club 5-liter box wine, the White Zinfandel. So that's what my parents would have at their house growing up. And, you know, when I was home from college and, you know, it's just, it's really affordable and I think it's a great value for the money. So I unfortunately, you know, to my wife's disappointment, don't really appreciate anything that's more than $10. I just can't tell the difference.
You know what? That's okay. We all have our own likes and dislikes. And if you're a White Zinfandel fan, you're a White Zinfandel fan. But we might be able to squeak in a rosé there, here and there with your taste buds, maybe. But
we'll that's have her to favorite. See it. So we compromise with $30 bottles of rosé to get fancy.
Oh, no, we can find some good $10, $15 of rosé. Let me tell you, I'll give you a list. I'll send you a list. So, Travis, like wine, though, as we're joking about it, I mean, it's so funny that you said it's something that your parents had, because I'm a big believer that our lives are very much like a wine in some respects, because there's different stages of it, right? There's a beginning, there's roots, there's the development, and there's the aging process. And that's true of both a really good vineyard versus, our really good lives. So I always like to ask people the question of what has crafted your vineyard? What has crafted your life?
Yeah, my family is very, very important to me. I think partly just because of the way we grew up, but just the fact that I lived in a small town in the South, or, you know, Pensacola, it's a small 50,000 person town. And just, it, you know, you just went to church on Sundays and you took care of your elders and went over to grandma's house for, you know, during the week to mow their lawn, even though they could kind of probably find somebody to demote for them, you know, if they really wanted to, just have an excuse to go over. So, very close family unit, got a couple brothers. And so we luckily didn't have to move around a bunch either. So really had a very strong sense of coming from somewhere, mm-hmm. growing up. And then also my granddad was, really into, investing ever since he got out of the service in World War II. And so, kind of growing up with him as a huge influence, I became really interested in finance, investing, just money in general. And that's kind of where I picked up my love of looking at what's going on with the Wall Street Journal or what's going on with, you know, Kiplinger's was big back then. and it was just, I kind of fell in love with the idea of what people could accomplish with managing money well at a very young age, and started investing when I was in my teenage years, and went to college, got a nice scholarship, came out, didn't have any debt, very lucky there. And then I worked as a bond trader, saved up a bunch of money, quit, and traveled the world for a bit. And I met my now wife, and she had a bunch of student loan debt. So you know, your listeners can probably imagine what happened next. but that was my kind of journey up to having a business and running a business for my full time professional life. But kind of the undercurrents are deep family connections, deep connections in my community, really important to focus on education and create, you know, just creativity and love of learning. And that was probably my background, my bedrock that led me to this point.
And I mentioned when I did the introduction, which I try not to use jargon, but I just forget sometimes, I mentioned that you're a CFA, which stands for Chartered Financial Analyst. And people, you know, usually know what a CFP is, a Certified Financial Planner. But that's not, a chartered financial analyst isn't something that people, I don't think they often understand what that really, what that undertaking really is. It is not a check the box kind of test. It's a very advanced test that you take in order to use that designation. I know I've told people that and I hate to use the word back in the day, but when I took the test, it was a 10-hour test, and now it's 6 hours, equally as hard. But it was, you know, it was a test of endurance. And the CFA test is also a test of endurance. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So there's three levels of the CFA. You take level one and generally have to wait usually a year between each level. And if you don't pass, then you have to wait to take it again the next year. So most people, I would say the average time it takes them to get it when they start the CFA program is probably about 4 years. Because you have to go through a series of exams to pass each one. And if you miss any of them, then you have to wait. You have another year added on to your timetable there. So I found it really worthwhile to go through. It's basically kind of like getting a graduate level understanding of investing and money management and finance without having to spend a bunch of money and take time away from the workforce to go get said degree. And probably it's probably a lot harder than most master's type programs, probably at anything but a top school. Maybe harder than the top schools. I don't know. Some of my friends that go to those top schools said it's more about the networking and, you know, the drinking after class. Mm-hmm. And nobody really cares about grades. But I think that the CFA, when somebody hears of a CFA, that person's kind of a specialist in investing. That's what that really means. And you usually see that kind of credential with people that are involved in managing pension funds or mutual funds or managing money for very like high net worth individuals. And a CFP is great too. It's also very difficult, rigorous credential. And that's more of you know, folks that are working with your mass affluent that are the primary care people. They're the quarterbacks of the financial life, and they're managing many things, you know, including taxes, estates, your investments, your budgeting, insurance, all kinds of different angles. So a really good arrangement is oftentimes, you know, having the CFP be the quarterback and having different specialists that are running, you know, depending on level of complexity, other parts of your life. So it's kind of confusing, you know, certainly for people who are not in the industry. But it's a great idea to have kind of a manager of kind of everything. And then that person can kind of run an interference for you or manage other relationships on an as needed basis, you know, depending on if your life is very complex or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're the people that kind of hire the CFAs. I mean, you know, the CFPs of the group are the ones that go out and say, okay, well, you know, we understand asset allocation. We understand the investment management piece at a very high level, but we're going to go out and hire somebody that actually does what you were saying at the level of, you know, integral investment management. And you're doing all the analysis behind that. So what took you from being in that role, especially bond management, which has always intrigued me? You know, people think the glory is behind stock management, but to be completely honest with you, I've always found, and maybe this is because of my pension background, but I've always found that management of bonds is so much more interesting. And I don't think people often recognize the risk associated with it either. But what took you from that to, I'm going to focus on helping people with large student loans?
Yeah.
Or student loans in general.
That's a great question. I mean, so in the bond world, you have thousands and thousands of different issuers that want to lend for a project, and the market gets to set the interest rate. So the interesting part is to say that you're the city of, I live in St. Louis, so we'll say the city of St. Louis wants to take out a bunch of debt to build, repay all the roads in the whole city. And so they don't have the money to do that up front, but they have all this tax revenue that's coming in over the next 20 years. And so they use that as a way to go get debt from the market, and the market sets their interest rate. So the people who actually set the interest rate are the investors. Like, I was in that role. So I was, you know, a bond trader, and I had to go and invest money for a mutual fund that people were giving us. And the portfolio managers are making kind of the decisions of what kind of issues to choose. And then the trader's job is to go out and get a bunch of different, to basically implement some of the ideas of the portfolio management team. And in the bond world, it's not as simple as pressing a button. You have to actually go find the bonds and then negotiate them. So it can be really high risk. So as an example, you know, I had trades where I made hundreds of thousands of dollars on that trade for the mutual fund, and then had trades where I lost hundreds of thousands. Luckily, I had a lot more of the gaining trades than the losing trades in terms of good execution. But I basically decided that wasn't what my calling was. I'm a pretty extroverted person. I love talking to people. I love feeling like I'm having an impact on an individual person's life. And a mutual fund manager or trader is having a big impact and getting investors better returns. They're certainly using in other parts of their life for good purposes, but you don't get to meet face-to-face the people you're managing the money for, or at least feel like you're having a really positive impact on their life. So it's, I think, more of a pure kind of process-oriented engineering type of personality that would not need to be talking to people that much to be happy. And for me, it just wasn't a great fit, I think. So that's one of the reasons why I decided I didn't want to do that for my career. And in terms of the student loan piece, I had picked one thing I loved about bond trading is I learned a ton of Excel skills. I was really, really good at putting massive amounts of information into Excel and finding things out of it. So I made a model for my then girlfriend, now wife, student debt when we started dating, and she told me she had a bunch of med school loans. So we refinanced them. But we only made that decision after I made this model, and it was really complicated. You could do forgiveness. You could maybe get an income-based plan. You could, you know, try to do some sort of a 5, 10, 7-year refinancing and lower the interest rate. There was a lot of options. And so I made a model for that, and I shared it online, and it got hundreds of thousands of views and thousands of downloads from one of these major media publications. And I realized that even though I wasn't trying to have a business was desperately needed. And so I decided to make this my full-time focus in October 2016. And since then, we've had about 1,100 clients and about $310 million of student loans that we've advised. So it's obviously grown a little bit from there. But it's really fascinating and enjoyable because we're able to help people, but also we get a front row seat to the student loan crisis that's developing in this country.
Mm-hmm. I think it's developed. Yeah. So, people have heard me say so many times, you know, at 1.52 trillion, is that what it's at right now? In outstanding student loan and something like 11% are in foreclosure or something like that. It's a ridiculous, or default, I should say. It's a ridiculous dollar figure if you think about that, right? So you know, it really is very disturbing to me as a person, what we've allowed to happen. And it's heartbreaking when I see that so many students don't understand what they're getting themselves into. I know that's why they had them start taking that quiz before they even took the loan out. You know, you have to walk through and take that I understand quiz, I call it. You know, but they're not putting it together. Like when it comes out and says your payment on this amount will be, you know, $100 a month, they look at that and say, oh, okay, $100 a month, but it's $100 a month and then another $100 a month. And then another $100 a month. And by the time they're graduating, it's $400 a month. And they're looking at that saying, oh my gosh, what do I do? And it's not like it's an easy thing to figure out either. When you start looking at income-based repayment plans and forgiveness plans that are out there. And then, you know, we start talking about capitalization of interest. Oh my goodness. How is the average student walking out of college supposed to understand this?
Well, what's interesting is that the undergraduate situation is not as bad as the grad and professional school loan situation, because with the undergrad loans, the limits of what an individual can borrow as an undergraduate student are actually very strict. So that $30,000 number being the average debt that the typical college student comes out with, that's because Stafford loans are pretty limited to, like, you know, it's like $7,000 to $10,000 a year, I think. And I have to take a look at the exact numbers.
Depending on the year,
But it's small, and you can get a little bit extra if you file your taxes not as a dependent on your parents' tax return. But at most, you might come out of, you know, undergrad with a very modest amount of debt. And then really the people who have the huge debt loads from undergraduate are parents. The Parent Plus loan system is an uncapped loan system, meaning that you can take out as much Parent Plus loans as you would like up to the cost of attendance. And you're only allowed to take Parent Plus loans for an undergraduate student. That's your child. So the Parent Plus system, I actually find a lot of people that are contacting me are in their 60s or 70s, and they might owe $100,000 or more for their child or multiple children's education. And then the students have a lot of debt, but the parents are even in even worse shape. So I very rarely will find these days a undergraduate who has a ton of debt that they are just totally screwed from that's in their name alone. The undergrad situation is bad, but it could be worse. The graduate school and professional school world, however, that uncapped borrowing arrangement, unlike the Parent Plus loans, they're not allowed anymore for graduate school and professional school loans. So you take all the loans out in your own name for grad school. And then furthermore, there's no limit on the amount that you can borrow, which this happened in 2006 with the passing of the Grad Plus program. And it's really kind of funny or sad. I don't know which word you choose, but you can see the tuition at a lot of universities for their grad school programs after this passed. It just skyrocketed. It went way up. And why is that? Well, they figured out that if you can borrow up to the cost of attendance, then what's an easy way to increase revenue? Increase the cost of attendance. And so that's what a lot of places did. And what you now have, since you don't have any private involvement in our underwriting standards over whether or not it's a good decision to take out a degree. And so, for example, a chiropractor, the average chiropractor now will graduate with about $200,000 to $250,000 of student loans, and they'll make $50,000 a year. The typical dentist will graduate with about $300,000 of student loans, and they'll have about $120,000 of income a year. That's not to say that there are not successful chiropractors and dentists, but what's happening in a lot of schools is university officials, in the absence of any kind of consumer protections, are out and out lying to people. And in some cases, doing something that, if it's not legally fraud, I think it should be considered fraud.
So your passion is strong as my passion on this. The wording that you're using, I mean, you know, people think I'm being Amy when I say, you know, that I think it's legally illegal. It's a term that sounds contradictory, but it just seems like we're allowing something in this country that is so morally wrong. And I don't get it.
Right. I mean, I get it. It's money.
Well, I get that as a country.
I mean, so when I was a bond trader, I kind of lost my trust, my default trust of people, because I dealt all the time with folks that were Wall Street, you know, just Wall Street personalities. And you know, when you're dealing with somebody on Wall Street, that there are good people there, but at the end of the day, if they can get the better of you on a transaction, make a lot of money on your mistake, they will. And so the only person that's going to protect you is yourself from knowing what you're doing. And so the problem with that is, if you have a huge asymmetry in the information and the expertise, that's kind of the reason for any kind of consumer protection laws. And so, you know, I mean, you can decide, well, some are reasonable, some are, you know, unnecessary restrictions on doing business. And I get that there's a legitimate discussion of that. But what's not okay is, I had just the other day, I talked to a chiropractor. She said one of her friends is applying to chiropractic school. And she said, what was the presentation like for the orientation? What did they tell you about what your income was going to be? And she said, the orientation person that worked for the school said that we're definitely going to be making six figures, which is an out and out lie. They don't make six figures. I have chiropractors that are struggling to make 30. And these are people that can't even find jobs in a lot of cases. So the issue is, there's zero accountability for the schools, except for, do they default on their student loans or not 3 years out? And that's it. So as long as you can get people to not default on their student loans 3 years out, you're good. And a lot of the schools hire consultants, not kind of related to what I do, but they're default management consultants, and they'll make sure that you're signed up for forbearance and making no payments, even though the interest is ballooning, for 3 years, which is the max period for forbearance. And then the forbearance period ends, and they're able to not have any accountability anymore, then the school doesn't have to care. So that, you know, it's just, it's laughable how the federal government is being fleeced with all of this. And the beneficiaries are people that open, you know, private schools, maybe universities that want to have a lot more revenue to invest in other things that they prefer to do. There's a lot of for-profit schools out there that are benefiting from this. But I actually think the biggest beneficiaries are your typical big name institutions that are, you know, increasing the number of programs and schools and colleges at a very rapid pace, not necessarily the for-profit schools. I mean, everybody's kind of making money, but the people that are charging, you know, the $400,000 for a dental school education, I mean, they're contributing to the problem way more than a really shady for-profit school that opens up a $10,000 barber institute, you know, just from a taxpayer hit standpoint. But yeah, tell me a little bit about your frustrations with the student loan system. I'm real curious.
It's just, you know, I just don't feel that they're educated enough. I don't feel that we educate people going into this well. I don't feel we educate the parents. I don't feel we educate the student. I just don't feel there's education around it. And I feel like Joe Messenger is, you know, the gentleman that does a lot of pre-college approval planning, and something that he said really, really, really struck home with me when he said, you know, when we go purchase a house, we have to get pre-approved for that, right? We can't just go randomly purchase a house without some sort of pre-approval. Yet we spend just as much money as a society, if not more sometimes, on purchasing a college education, and there is no pre-approval process for that. And in a million years, nobody would ever enter into a cost like that, or any type of price like that, without normally doing their homework about how much is this going to cost me in the long run. We don't buy a car, we don't buy a house, we don't buy anything without thinking about, you know, what that monthly payment is going to be and how this is going to affect our lives. But it seems that we're doing that with education. That's my perception. And it's very frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, I would agree.
And I can't fathom the interest rates on these loans. It drives me absolutely crazy that we can go out and buy a car for less than we will pay in interest rates on our education. To me, that's just one of those things. Like, are you serious? Like, we take our education and have a higher cost to it in this established world, in this developed country, and it costs 6.8%, 7%. I don't even know where to go with that other than it just drives me crazy.
Yeah. I mean, well, the UK has a similar system that they recently implemented. And so they, you know, they have a really high interest rate for student loans now, and it's really a convoluted system. And the incentives are basically to go on these income driven programs in a lot of cases and draw it out for forever and roll the dice with the tax burden that's going to happen when the loans are forgiven. So listeners that don't know, you know, if you pay on a income driven program, like pay as you earn for 20 years, at the end of that, you have to pay taxes mm-hmm. on any forgiven mm-hmm. balance. And there's some people that are just not even thinking about that. And there's a lot of my clients that are saving and investing in a brokerage account to prepare for that, but putting away $500 a month for the next 20 years to be ready for that. But it's definitely a kind of a warped incentive structure, because one analogy that I'll give is the government has a student loan system where there's two kinds of borrowers. There's borrowers that are up on the mountaintop, and there's borrowers that are in a floodplain. And, you know, some folks, if you go to an in-state dental school in Texas, you're going to come out with maybe 100, 150,000 of debt, and you're going to make 150 to 200,000 over the course of your career. And that's actually a pretty decent trade. And that person's going to refinance and lock in a low interest rate and pay all the debt back and go with a private lender, versus a borrower who goes to one of these high cost private schools, say in San Francisco, to go to dental school there. You might come out with $500,000 in student loan debt and make less money if you stay there, because there's so many new grads in that area that want to live in that city. So even within professions, there's these huge warped situations going on. And so what happens is, if you think about the Texas dentist being on the mountaintop and the California dentist being in the floodplain, The government is losing all those folks on the mountaintop to private lenders that are making really high profits on a low default rate by giving them, you know, 3%, 4%, 5% interest rates. And then the people who are paying the 7%, 8% that are left over are actually people that are never actually going to pay that. They're going to basically pay until the loans are forgiven, and then either have the taxpayer pick up the balance for the forgiven debt because they can't pay it, or perhaps they're doing that strategically to pay that balance. So it's I don't think that we're going to see any kind of a change for at least the next 4 to 6 years of how loans will be taken out, because any change that's been proposed is only going to affect borrowers that are not already currently enrolled in a program. And so if you kind of think about the cycle, like a med student joining, going to med school, they borrow until, 2022 if they started today. So I think that if they are successful at changing this system, it'll be about then. But realistically, I think they're going to keep kicking the can down the road until the crisis starts finally occurring in 10 to 20 years.
It's so scary when I see people, and that's scary. Well, yeah, scary in a way, because I was around when the mortgage crisis happened. I mean, I date back to the early 90s when I got into this industry, and everybody thinks about that. And yet when we look at the student loan crisis, if people can't pay their bills, I don't think people understand that this debt isn't ever forgivable. It's not like you can have your house repossessed and, okay, I'm done with the debt. Student loan debt isn't something that can be wiped out even with bankruptcy. So,
yeah. There's a few nuances to that. So federal student loans are the least bankruptible. Right. Because they'll garnish your wages, they'll go after Social Security benefits even. So federal student loans are impossible to get rid of, but the way you get rid of them is through going for an income-driven option to plan for the tax bomb, or to go with something like public service loan forgiveness that's tax-free after 10 years. And with private lenders, there are in some states some room to negotiate a little bit. It depends on the state, but I've seen some people work with attorneys specializing in student loans in states that have specifically really high borrower protection laws, and have them offer pretty attractive settlements in bankruptcy. But you're right that as a whole, it's not like credit card debt where you can walk away for pennies on the dollar and start over. It's totally different. So I think that people, if you have student debt, there's ways to manage it though. You don't have to necessarily be hopeless. Mm-hmm. There's actually a lot of ways that you can be very financially secure, even if you made a really, really bad decision with whatever program that you went to, or even a decision that you just kind of are neutral about and maybe wish that you go into a cheaper school. That's probably the typical reaction of people that I work with. But there are options that you can do to have hope again. And a lot of it involves having a super high savings rate.
And so I think those are in some of the details that you get into when you're working with somebody on a one-on-one basis, right? I mean, because it's so hard when somebody says, what should I do about these student loans? I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so many options that you have available to you without digging into the details of your specific situation. I would be remiss in giving you any kind of guidance around student loans. They're not simple at all. There's so many different nuances. I worked on a case not too long ago that had FFEL loans actually still, and happened to be a teacher. And so we were able to really take advantage of the fact that she had some FFEL loans and she had some unsubsidized and subsidized loans. And we kept them separate. We made sure that they were separate for planning purposes. So, there's lots of different options that are out there that are so specific to your situation that I think it takes somebody who has really got a strong expertise in this particular area to be giving good guidance on it. I think this is another area that it's not just general knowledge around loans. There's so many nuances that it really does give somebody a better chance if they reach out to somebody who's an expert on that. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah. And without being too self-serving, I'll give an example. So say somebody's got $200,000 of student debt and it's a 6% interest rate, and they're a nurse practitioner making, you know, about $80,000 a year. And we'll assume that they're single. And so that person would be paying, if you're just assuming they get kind of adjustments with their income, they'd pay about $500 a month on the pay-as-you-earn program. And that's going to result in a cost of about $166,000 over 20 years, so less than the $200,000 that they borrowed. And then that would leave them with a cost with a balance that's left over of about $273,000 at the end of those 20 years. And then they'd have to pay about $100,000 in taxes. And so then the question is would you rather pay about $270,000 over 20 years? Or if you refinanced that and got a pretty solid interest rate, you'd pay about $250,000 over 10 years. So just to recap, about $270,000 over 20 or $250,000 over 10. And the math is going to say, because of inflation, that you would rather go for forgiveness in a scenario like that, because $270,000 over 20 years gives you a better cost in purchasing power. And, you know, adjusting for purchasing power in today's dollars, that's cheaper. And then what you can also say is that you have to make choices, right? So let's give a name to this nurse practitioner. Let's call her Sarah. And we'll say that Sarah has a choice of either putting the money into her student loans, or she has a choice of doing something else with it. And so if she went to a big company and refinanced, she'd have to pay $2,000 a month on her student loans. And that probably means that between housing and transportation and other, you know, food and just living, she's not going to have a lot of money left over for other things. Whereas if she went with a forgiveness option in that scenario, she's got about $500 a month going towards her loans. Maybe she puts about $300 a month going for the tax bomb into a investment account. And maybe additionally, she could afford to put away a max contribution for retirement, perhaps in a 401k or something like that. So she could put away about probably close to the maximum if she put that money into retirement instead of her student loans. And in 20 years, if she does that, she's going to have Sarah's going to have vastly more assets to live on and live her life with than if she continues to try to pay her student loans off with some $2,000 a month scheme. And what's kind of nuts is, let's say that Sarah's got a really clear option in front of her where she's got a clear idea of what she wants to do. But then Sarah meets Tom, and Tom doesn't have student loans, and he makes about $50,000 a year. And now his income has to be counted into that strategy. And so then Sarah's got to decide, does she want to file her taxes separately to exclude Tom and cost herself some money in tax penalties, or does she want to file jointly and include his income in the calculation? And then does that mean that she shouldn't refinance, that she should, or sorry, that she shouldn't go for forgiveness, and that she should just pay it all back? And that's just one example, but I thought I would just give that illustration to show kind of, because you know, it kind of sounds like student loans. Well, what do you do exactly, right? So that's kind of the idea: is you got a bunch of debt, you don't know what to do with it, and if you have, I really focus my services on people who have six figures of student loan debt. We help people in the five figure world, but five figure student loan world is a little easier. You've got $35,000 in debt at a 6% and you make $50,000 a year. Okay, you know, assuming that you're working in the private sector, just go shop a bunch of rates, try to get a cashback bonus, and just refinance and pay it off. It's you know, that's when it becomes kind of like Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman, just, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get rid of debt. Debt's evil. But over $100,000, it can get, and student loan debt, it can get really, really complicated. So kind of think of it like, you know, doing your own taxes. You know, if you all you do is have a W-2 and you work and for a living, you don't have any dividends or real estate or anything like that. Yeah, you probably do your own taxes. It's probably pretty easy, just, you know, with a software program. But then if you have really complicated taxes, or you have a business or depreciation, or you have rentals or something like that, you know, you're probably costing yourself money by not having a professional do your taxes for you. And you're almost certainly costing a lot of time.
Which is money. I mean, you know, that ultimately is money, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, if you make over a certain dollar hourly wage, then it's kind of a no-brainer to outsource, right? Should I should I mow my own lawn or should I hire somebody to do it for me? Well, it depends. Do I enjoy doing my own lawn? Because then I'm getting a benefit that's not monetary. Mm-hmm. But if I don't, if it's just a task that I do, you know, then I outsource it. Like, you know, one of the best investments I've ever made is going ahead and hiring a cleaning service for our house. It's done wonders for my marriage, and the house is clean, and I don't have to worry about, you know, upsetting my wife because the kitchen's a mess. It was a great decision, and luckily I'm doing something where my hourly wage is greater than that, so it makes a lot of sense to outsource that, and it also gives me peace mm-hmm. of mind. I think it kind of, this calculation works well for really anything. Like if you're thinking about hiring a financial mm-hmm. planner, well, you could go work with any of these automated services that are really cheap. You could do it yourself. You could pay the money and work with a fee only planner. And, you know, the math is going to say that most people should work with a fee only planner because of the psychology of investing and the fact that most people perform really, really poorly making their own financial decisions. But it's kind of a decision of, you know, do you want the peace of mind? Do you want mm-hmm. to outsource it? Do you not want to have to worry mm-hmm. at night? And I know that, you know, as a XYPN, NAPFA kind of a person, a CFP, you really, you know, can understand that.
Absolutely. And I think that we also need to look at those different, I guess one of the reasons that I thought having you on the show would be important is because I think it's really critical that people look at what's affecting them the most. Like I would rather that they go and work with you on something like this than not work with anybody or think that they have to have, you know, a full financial plan. Like, you know, there's a lot of services out there that are what I call pain point services, right? You got a tax problem, go to like a CPA or enrolled agent. You've got a student loan program, go to somebody like Travis. He's going to get you through that. Not saying you shouldn't do a financial plan, but sometimes you're just so focused on what is keeping you up at night that you can't think about anything else until you get that problem solved. And I think that's, you know, that's a really critical, you know, thought process when you're worried about something. What is the core of that worry? And that's the expert that you need to go get at that moment. you know, that's the person that you need to go seek. And so what I see a lot of right now, a lot is how am I ever going to get out from underneath a student loan debt? How am I ever going to even buy a house? How am I going to move out from my parents? How am I going to buy a car? When am I ever going to be able to afford to have a family? Those are really sad thoughts to me.
Yeah.
You know, if you're saying that and you're thinking, I can't get married and have a family because of my student loans. We should never think like that. That should never be the basis of what we're doing to make our lives happier. And so, that's one of the reasons why I thought it was so critical to have you on the show and for people to listen to this, because I want them to know that there are options out there. And, you know, I also want them to know a little bit about you. So let's say that they, you know, they hear this and they're really interested in the services, but there's one of the things that I notice when people first start working with me is, there's this feeling of I should know this stuff and I feel stupid for not knowing this stuff, which, by the way, anybody thinking that, no, this is extremely complex. Even financial planners, even CFPs, don't always know this stuff. A lot of them don't, quite honestly. And I have to reach out to experts personally, in certain situations when things get really deep in the weeds. So, you know, I just want you to feel and know that that's not the case at all. But I think when people know you a little bit better or a little bit about you, that they can pick something out about you, then they feel a little more comfortable. So I'm going to ask you just a few questions about you personally so that maybe listeners actually feel a little more comfortable, just about you in general, Travis. So as a kid, were you ever included in money conversations at all?
Definitely. One time I had to give my parents a loan because they didn't have enough money to pay the bills. So You know, that's kind of when my mom decided that she had to go back to work and it wasn't really an option, but they, you know, I remember it cause I was like 16 maybe. And I had some money saved up from like working part-time jobs. And they were just like, Travis, you know, we, have cashed in all of our savings bonds and we need to, you know, borrow some money to pay for, and, you know, obviously they're paying for my expenses, right? I'm the child in that situation. They're covering all of my, you know, activities and things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they needed, you know, a little bit of money to make it in the next paycheck. And, so I was, probably always the most interested in money of any of my three, the three of us, my two brothers and I. And, I was involved in money conversations, pretty much as much as I wanted to be. You know, my parents would make the decisions, but they would always ask what I was thinking.
That's a hard money lesson to learn a little bit too. I mean, to have your parents come to you and ask to borrow money, or a great money lesson in some respects, because it really probably woke you up to, you know, some things that as most kids would never be faced with. Are there money mistakes that your family or you actually could talk about that you think others could learn from?
Well, there was one really bad one that shows you why there's a lot of people that need help out there. So my mom listed her retirement assets under the wrong asset column on her FAFSA.
Oh no.
So she was filling out the FAFSA, and you know that retirement assets don't count in a determination of financial aid. Mm-hmm. So the column that she put it in made it look like she had that she had, you know, a couple hundred thousand sitting there in savings that she could use to pay my college with. Mm-hmm. And so my financial aid offers were not all that good, and I didn't know why until a couple of years afterwards. I kind of discovered how she had filled it out, and she, you know, I was the first one to go to college and you know, out of my brothers and everything. And she's a very sharp person. It's just a, you know, complicated form with a bunch of lines and the, you know, kind of, you know, sort of middle of the computer age, beginning of the computer age, you know, when things weren't as easy to do online as they are today. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, she made a terrible mistake. And, you know, if I had not had a scholarship, luckily it didn't impact me because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have loans because I went with the scholarship route. But if I had, you know, if I had not lucked out in that direction, then that would have really hurt. So mm-hmm. that was one mistake. And luckily they made a lot of really great decisions too. I mean, my parents are really good with trying to have a high savings rate and having money put away for retirement and, you know, not having car loans. They always paid cash mm-hmm. for vehicles. So, you know, they did make some good financial decisions too, but yeah, it just shows you that even somebody who's pretty on top of it and really tries to stay organized mm-hmm. can make a mistake that ends up being a 5 or 6 figure.
That's decision. A big one. Yeah. And you know, it's a very common, one of the reasons we like to review the FAFSAs for our clients is because that's a very common mistake that we find. Very common. And when we explain to people what they mean by investments, you know, it and show them the difference that can make in financial aid, even just in, and sometimes when it's a CSS, you know, financial aid form, that's really, really, really important that the people understand those forms.
And I really don't understand why they don't put in giant bolded highlighted letters, do not include 401k, IRA assets and similar things. You know, it's just mind-boggling. Like, it's just mind-boggling. It's almost like they're trying to screw people over and you know, make people make mistakes, but that's
not an easy,
you know, but that's the reality because the system is not designed with the user in mind. Mm-hmm. It's designed with just all of the bureaucratic hurdles and obstacles in mind. Like the student loan system is very complicated because every time they come out with a new loan system, they always leave the old legacy rules around from the prior loan system. So the you know, if you thought about having one type of IBR program, yeah, that sounds great. But the problem is you're going to create that program and you're going to leave all the old programs around, and then you're just adding layers upon layers of confusion. And you know, it's in a perfect world, what I do would not be needed and I would not exist, and that would be fine with mm-hmm. me. I would go find something else to do. Mm-hmm. But until the world becomes perfect, I love what I do and I'm glad that I can take people's stress off their plate.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, there is talking about stress, you know, there are their financial concerns that you have for you and your family in today's world?
Probably, I had one that I protected myself for. So I was concerned that, you know, my wife and I are newly married, and I was concerned that were she to become pregnant, obviously I can die before the baby is viable and the baby could still be born, right? So I wanted to make sure that I had enough life insurance protection so that I would have enough assets that it wouldn't be needed in about 10 years. So I bought a 10-year term life policy. It only cost me like $20-something a month and $1 million of protection so that if something does happen to me, you know, she's going to be able mm-hmm. to buy a house at a mortgage, mm-hmm. fully fund the college account and not really have to think of, okay, what do I need to do with the money situation right now? It's just mostly going to be, you know, an emotional wound that she would recover from, you know? So, so that's one thing that I did, that I was a little concerned about financially. I don't know. I mean, but I'm every bit as optimistic too, as I am concerned about things. Mm-hmm. Like I think that, you know, there's never been a better time to be an American than right now, because my granddad was going over, you know, to fight in the Pacific in World War II and had lived through the Great Depression. That was his era growing up. And my era growing up was watching the Power Rangers and listening to, you know, going to, you know, watching MTV and, you know, going to the gym, you know, like that was my period growing up. So yeah, I have got concerns, but I think that if, you know, if we're lucky enough to bring a child into the world, I'm extremely optimistic for that child and that child's future.
I love that when we put it in perspective, right? I love that you added that in about your grandfather. It's perspective of our lives. We forget what the others have been through. Would you say that you've received any financial advice that you really wish you hadn't?
That's a good question. The big purchase that I regret was I spent some extra money buying a fancy looking SUV that had leather seats, sunroof, really pretty appearance. And it ended up having tons of mechanical problems and just cost me so much money. And I bought it used, but I paid cash for it with a little bit of help from my parents when I was in college. And so I should have just, you know, bought a reliable vehicle that wasn't super fancy with lots of bells and whistles that could break. So in terms of like financial advice that I got, I mean, I probably really haven't received any terrible financial advice that I've ever acted upon. Cause I guess I always like second, checking everything that I hear. Mm-hmm. If somebody tells me something, I always want to seek out a second or a third source or opinion to kind of verify that. And, cause I think at some point, everybody in their life gets approached by somebody that sells a high commission financial product, you know, whole life insurance or, you know, annuities or something like that. And, you know, they have a great sales training. So they really approach you well. It's a very personalized outreach and they want to hang out or go out for a coffee and it seems so nice. And then you kind of wonder like, well, what is this about really? And so I did some more research. Like I had some guy from back home wanted me to come intern for him selling whole life insurance. And I was a freshman or sophomore in college and, you know, nobody's giving internships to freshmen and sophomores. So, you know, I did some research and very quickly realized like that was pretty lousy. I also had help from my granddad there. I told him a little bit about what the internship would be. And he said, run for the hills.
Smart granddad. I really like this guy.
I know.
So I know that we have talked an awful lot about student loans. We've gotten to know you a little bit better. Is there anything in particular that you can put your finger on that so far in your life that you can say has been a big accomplishment for you, either personally, financially?
Probably having the stupidity or courage, or I don't know what you would call it, of quitting my job and starting a business has been the best financial decision I've ever made. I didn't like the cubicle lifestyle. I wasn't super happy waking up every day. You know, I wasn't super unhappy, but it was just, I wasn't really feeling like I was meeting, I think my pastor once said, you want your calling to intersect with the world's great need. And that's a great thing to do. So I didn't feel like I was meeting that. And I took kind of my dad calls it a sabbatical. I kind of considered myself done working. I wouldn't want any more of that. I was just gonna, I don't know, write books and, just write poetry for a living. I didn't really have much of a plan, but I just knew I needed to take some time off from the working world and then started my business. And that was possible because I had a lot in savings and a lot, of runway to not have to worry about burning through all my personal, investments and cash. And that gave me enough flexibility to start a business. And now the business, I make more than I did when I was a bond trader. And I'm changing people's lives in a way that I wasn't before. I even think that long term, my business is going to prevent people from committing suicide. And I don't say that in a kind of a promotional or a salesy kind of a way. I say it authentically because the suicide rates for veterinarians and dentists and other professionals is significantly higher than it is for the average population. And one of the sentiments that I hear all the time is that they feel trapped, they feel hopeless, they feel depressed because they feel like they can't undo any of these big life decisions they made, and they feel trapped. And so then you have easy access to very lethal chemicals and the knowledge to do it. And so then any kind of mental health issues that are exacerbated by, you know, burdens that you're feeling, you can act on those, and people do, and it's tragic. And so I like to think that in creating all this free content and helping people make plans and giving people hope when there was previously despair, at some point by the law of large numbers, I'm going to save someone's life. And my wife is a physician, so she directly does that, but to indirectly do that and also be working on helping people with their finances is super exciting for me. So I wake up and love what I do, whereas before I just didn't have that deep passion. So if anybody's listening to this and you're kind of in a similar boat to where I was a couple of years ago, my recommendation would be that you get up to $100,000 of cash and investments, probably with at least $20,000 or $30,000 of cash, and just quit for a while without a plan, and try to reset your mental clock, travel a little bit, visit friends and family, look for inspiration, and then try to come up with a business model, undercharge for your services initially just to gain proof that the product that you're offering works and helps people, and then start gradually increasing your prices as people demand your services more and more.
That is an amazing journey that you have been on and that you shared. And I do agree that some of the most highly paid individuals actually have the biggest struggles. I was at a conference not too long ago that was for attorneys in Florida, and I was astounded by the alcoholism rate, the suicide rate, the depression rate that goes along with those jobs. And a big piece of it did boil down to, especially in the younger attorneys, the debt. They were looking at $250,000, $300,000 in debt and just thinking, and some of them hated it. They hated being attorneys, but they didn't have any choices. They didn't feel that. So I agree, you're directly affecting people's lives, and that should be considered success by all means. So one final question that is on the serious side that I love to ask people, and that is, what feeds Travis's soul? What gets you charged up?
My faith is very important to me. So I feel like everything that I do should be for kind of a higher purpose beyond just making, you know, a buck or getting famous or something like that. And certainly I am prone to the same kind of temptations that anybody is when you're doing something that's public like that. But that's kind of my kind of where my mindset is coming from things. And then the actions, like how I try to live my life. I mean, it sounds really weird, but like I just genuinely love fixing people's money issues and just trying to get them positioned better. Like it's kind of funny. Like when I have a friend who is not liking their job, like sometimes I'll kind of bother them to the point of it almost being badgering, but I'm like trying to help them break free from that so that they can go out and start their own business, and talking with them about business plan, like how much cash runway they have and like how can they slash their expenses so that they have even more flexibility. Because I've seen people do things that have totally changed their lives, like mindset, they're passionate, they're happy. And I just want that for everyone. So that's probably what feeds my soul, is just seeing other people that are successful and happy and just feel like they've had a huge positive life change by something that I was able to help them with. So I think that that's probably why I do what I do with this business, is because I just very much enjoy it. And it's just super fun for me to do, just having that that energy that comes from just knowing that you've changed someone's life for the better.
Well, that's not an inviting answer. I don't know what would be. So when people are looking to sit down with you, with them understanding that is your mission to give them some comfort in a situation that they are absolutely stressed out about, then they can take a breath and maybe feel like their soul can be fed. So we are very fortunate to have you today and to talk through. I feel like we could talk for hours about this topic, although both of us have commitments this evening and can't. But I think that, you know, if you want to know more about Travis and about his business, as I mentioned earlier, it's studentloanplanner.com is the website. We're also going to share other information about him and social media information about him in the show notes so that you can contact him and maybe schedule an appointment or at least an initial consultation to see if Travis can't help you and give some light on a situation that you may feel very overwhelmed by, saying the least. So Travis, in closing, lightening up the mood just a little bit, I love to ask people. So you said earlier that White Zinfandel is your favorite wine, boxed White Zinfandel, you said. So tell me what you love to pair with that particular wine.
It's embarrassing to say, but watermelon.
Interesting.
Makes no sense. It's really aggravating to my wife, Christine, the things that I like to eat together. It just baffles her. But I'm a weird person. And if you're a weird person, you know, I guess there's more of us in the business world that are starting things because we like to not follow the rules. Very, very kind of odd. Maybe I'll say watermelon with cheese, throw that in there. Really one. Pretty weird.
Hey, you know what? We all have our random weirdness, right? That's what makes us individuals. If we were all the same, then we wouldn't experience anything different in life. So Travis, we want to say thank you so much for being on the show today. And again, we'll post all your information in our show notes. And we are just really honored to have somebody with your knowledge and experience, sharing that out there with the public. And I hope in the future we'll be able to have you back on and really dig into some more issues, especially as, you know, there's some things on the chopping block potentially, or some changes that could come down the road with student loans. And it'd be great to have that information updated. So we really do appreciate your time today and can't say thank you enough. So it's time to go have that glass of White Zinfandel with your watermelon and tell your wife thank you for sharing your weirdness.
Yeah, sure. And folks, you know, if you've got that out there, you know, studentloanplanner.com has got a bunch of free resources you can use, even if you're the kind of person that likes to self-provision. So get help. You know, don't do this alone.
Thanks again.
And that will about do it for this week's episode of Wine and Dime. You can visit Amy on the web at irvineadvise.com. Or you can follow her on Twitter at Amy Irvine Advise, or on her Facebook page, Irvine Wealth Planning Strategies. If you have any questions, comments, or topics that you would like to hear about, feel free to contact us through Twitter or Facebook. We will do our best to answer your questions. We would love to hear from you. And thank you for listening.